even if you're in an inflationary environment, the design of the system makes it such that you can move from an inflationary scenario to a deflationary scenario extremely quickly. And I think that's why, to a certain extent, central banks are trying to get rates down a little bit, because they know that even though we're in an inflationary environment, it could transition the other way very quickly, and they don't want that to happen. Deflation is the enemy of central banks. Now, to your point about volatility, something does have to give eventually, right? Unless the central bankers can pull off this global soft landing, at some point, vol is going to show up somewhere. Now, whether it shows up in the actual VIX, whether it shows up in currencies, whether it shows up in bonds or equities, you know, I don't know. But to your point, it's hard to see the next 6 months being as sanguine as the last 6 months.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Milkshakes Markets Madness. My name is John Consumita. This is Brent Johnson. Every week we come to you to talk about markets, the madness that follows the markets, and a little bit of Brent's dollar milkshake theory. If you're unfamiliar with what that is, you can learn more on our YouTube channel using the handle Milkshakes Pod. At the top, we have a Start Here playlist that will fill you in and get you caught up on the general idea of the dollar milkshake theory, which talks about the dollar's role in the global financial system. Speaking of madness, Brent, recently, you shared with us the announcement that you're doing a masterclass to talk about markets. Do you want to give us an update on that, or maybe just another quick pitch?
Yeah, I'll just give another quick pitch. You know, it's I did a couple of podcasts this last week, and I was at a conference last weekend. And, you know, it's always great to be able to go on there and give my thoughts. But even under the best of scenarios in those situations, you have 45 minutes to talk. And the reality is that there's a lot more than 45 minutes that goes into my thinking in this framework. The milkshake is not a one-time event. It's a process, and it's a framework for how I think markets play out over time. So it's really impossible for me to get everything across of what goes into that thinking, you know, in a short period of time, even if it's 45 minutes. So what I've decided to do is, and I've been thinking about this for a long time, but there's just a lot of work that goes into it, is I'm going to do like a full seminar slash day slash course on what all the different components are that go into the milkshake, and go into greater detail on each of those little components. And so that's going to come probably in August. We haven't figured out a date yet due to the, you know, some travel schedules and some logistics, but probably in August, we're going to have a day where, you know, we just go through all of this, and I can walk kind of through step by step everything that goes into it. So I'm excited to do that. It's going to be a lot of work, but I think it will put a lot of kind of meat on the bone, so to speak, and give people a better understanding of why I think what I do. Because I talked to so many people at a conference last week, and it happened several times. And you know, I interact with a lot of people on social media, and they get, well, when is this going to happen? When is this going to happen? And I feel like everybody just thinks there's going to be this big one-time event, and then we move on. And that's just not how I see it. And I hope by doing this, you know, this masterclass, it'll give a little bit more of a peek behind the curtain into what it actually is and why I think the way I do. So anyway, stay tuned for that.
Brent Johnson, you have a beautiful mind. And today you kind of have the beautiful mind look going. It's very Russell Crowe.
I took a shower for you. I got dressed up. Yeah.
You're having a good hair day. You know, one of the things, you know, doing this with you is just so fascinating to me is there's multiple layers to the dollar milkshake theory, but I don't think people even get past the headline or the title. Yeah. And the number of comments that we see on the YouTube channel and Twitter, which shows that people completely do not get it, has been part of probably one of the most fascinating parts of doing this. Now, the other part that's really interesting in terms of that thesis is also a lot of times the misunderstanding in terms of what it's used for. It's used for as a framework to kind of keep you composed. And I think that's another piece that people miss here. It's, you know, a lot of things that we talk about is not trying to predict the future, but preparing for it. And, you know, using the milkshake as a framework so that you're less anxious about the timeline.
No, that's exactly right. And I'm the first to say that it hasn't been exactly correct. But it's been a lot more correct than it has been wrong. And it has helped explain what has happened better than anything else that I've been able to come across. And so again, it's not a button that I can push and say yes or no, right or wrong. It's not that black and white, but it does kind of relieve some of the to your point, the anxiety of wondering what comes next or what could happen, because to a certain extent, you know, it is a description of how the system works and what the system can and cannot do and what can and cannot happen. And so that has, you know, if nothing else, it's provided me peace of mind, and I haven't been searching for the why is this happening. Whereas I think a lot of people, you know, have been caught in that, you know, especially the people who, you know, understand that fiat currency dies over time. And so therefore think that's going to happen either imminently or in the not too distant future, and are just continually frustrated by the dollar's relative strength versus other currencies. And I think if nothing else, this has helped explain what that is. So for people who have an open mind and are open to learning, you know, kind of how the system works and why this is taking so long to play out, I think this has, it certainly helped me, and I hope it's helped other people.
Yep. I think, you know, getting into the deeper layers of that topic and the overall macro aspects of that, I think is going to be very valuable. So stay tuned for more information on that. And speaking of macro, we also have been playing around with the Macro Alchemist on Twitter. You know, what we've been doing on Twitter is more or less just sharing a few charts here and there. But the plan with that is to not only take something like this course and go even further with it and maybe talk about some of these things on a more institutional level. You know, the Twitter account really has just been about, you know, sharing some charts and being a bit more part of that bigger macro conversation. But I think some of the things that we're going to be doing with that, which, you know, you can extrapolate here in a minute, is exciting, because it's going to give you the opportunity to go really deep on some think pieces and the things that, you know, keep you going and excited about being in markets every week.
Yeah, so it's very much related to what we're already doing, but it is its own little branch. You know, I have another friend who has been in the market. I've been in the markets. We're coming up on my 25th anniversary of when I started. I started in this business in summer of 99. So it's kind of surreal for me to say that out loud. But I have another friend who's been doing it for even longer than I have. He's been on the institutional side. So he's worked for very large investment banks and funds and pension funds. And he's much more in tune, I guess, with the deep dive analysis on the fundamental research. And so what we decided to do is we're going to start publishing some of the stuff that we just talk about. So similar to how you and I decided to start recording this, these conversations that we are having anyway, you know, in conjunction with him, decided to start publishing some of the stuff that we talk about anyway. And a lot of, you know, this show is kind of fun and lighthearted in many ways. And some of the stuff that's going to come through at Macro Alchemist is a little bit more deep dive, a little bit more serious, a little bit more institutional level, you know, analysis on stuff, as opposed to just talking about the madness of it all. And so, you know, we're going to be launching our first think piece next week. He's going to stay anonymous for now because he's got some other things that he's working on that he's just not ready to come out into the light. But at some point, he will probably do that. He's the author of this piece, but, you know, my thinking goes into it as well. So it's kind of a joint publication. And then the other thing we're going to be doing is we're going to be publishing some charts. And the charts are, you know, we've started sharing some of those already on Twitter. But really, when we share a chart there on Twitter, it's something that I'm already looking at anyway. And it's not just something that, hey, what's a cool chart that I go post? It's something that I've already looked at, and it's been kind of incorporated into my research or my analysis. And I love charts, and I really love long-term charts. And so what we're going to start doing is we're going to start posting on a more regular basis some of the charts that we're already looking at anyway. And so, you know, to the extent that that helps other people, you know, see the world the way we do, or get more into the mind of what goes into our analysis, you know, that'll be there for them.
Yeah, look, if we're doing a recording here once a week, 30 minutes to an hour, we do take the heart a lot of the comments, and that's kind of where some of this is being born. You know, people have questions about topics that we kind of fly by over, or within that hour, maybe they get frustrated because there's something that we haven't covered at all, or not in you know, significant depth for people's liking. So I think we're hoping to fill the gap with that and continue to keep this kind of intermediate and lighthearted, not necessarily lighthearted, but light in terms of how granular we get on some of these topics. So let's move into markets, because it was an interesting week in the sense of, you know, there was a variety of I would say madness, but definitely volatility. So despite the fact that volatility has been suppressed to almost record lows, you know, the first thing we should talk about, which is very macro and very significant to what, you know, potentially is going on in the economy and what the Fed is going to do is the employment data. Do you want to talk about that? And I can fill in some data points as you go.
Sure. Well, I thought, you know, this week was very reminiscent of many weeks prior. And that is that, you know, we had a lot of data come out this week. You know, most important was non-farm payrolls. And again, the headline came in hawkish. You know, it was better than expected. But then when you start looking under the hood, it's not quite as good as, you know, the headline says. And the revisions come in soft. And that's kind of been par for the course for most of the year. So you get kind of these, you know, these bursts of energy to the downside and then recovery to the upside. And so what's funny is so that in itself would breed volatility, but it seems by the end of the day or the end of the week, volatility is usually back down to its lows. And that, again, that's kind of been a hallmark of the year as well. But what I think this does is that the fact that the headlines keep coming in high or higher than expected, or at least in line, they're not all coming in extremely dovish. And what that, and it, even if these are manipulated, even if you're of the opinion that these are all fake, it doesn't change that that's what the headline is, right? And I think if the headlines continue to come in kind of at the level or stronger than expected, it makes it more challenging for the Fed to cut. Doesn't mean it's impossible, and it doesn't mean it will stop them. It just makes it harder for them to do so. And the reason I think that's important is because now other central banks around the world have started to cut. The ECB cut this week, the Bank of Canada cut this week. It's now expected that the Bank of England will cut sometime probably in the next month. There's been speculation that Australia would cut. Now they've kind of, their central bankers have pushed back on that a little bit and said, no, we're not really ready to do it. But you know, the point is that the hiking cycle for global central banks is probably over. But it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have a rush to these, you know, at the beginning of the year, we were going to have 7 cuts. But now that they've started to cut, oftentimes, historically, the Fed leads the way. The Fed is the first to ease. The Fed is the first to tighten. But now, remember, at the beginning of the year, the Fed was going to do all these cuts and the other central banks were not. And that led to dollar weakness. Well, now it's kind of been reversed. These other central banks have started to cut. And the Fed probably will, but it still hasn't happened yet, and it's not as clear. And if these headline numbers continue to come in, you know, either stronger than expected or even at expectations, it makes it harder for the Fed to cut. And so that's why I think as we get, but everything continues to get worse in Europe, in Canada, and these other places. So even if the Fed does cut, I'm of the expectation that these other places will be cutting as well and probably more aggressively than the Fed. And so that leads to relative dollar strength. And it also leads, and that then often will lead to higher volatility. So I try not to make too many predictions, or at least if I do make predictions, they're fairly loosely held. But I think the one, if I had to make a prediction for the next 6 months, which I think is a pretty safe is a pretty safe prediction, is that volatility will be higher over the next 6 months than it has been over the last 6 months. I don't know what will cause it, but I just have a hard time believing that we're going to have another 6 months with this low of volatility, especially with everything we have in the second half of the year.
I have a couple of questions that spin off of that. So the first one is why, and why around the fact of why are these other central banks cutting? You know, if we use the U.S. as the proxy, as the example, there's not necessarily a whole lot that would give the Fed permission. There's certain things where you could say, hey, the economy's rolling over, some things are slowing down. But then you get like the NFP or the CPI, and it's like, I don't know if cuts are coming. I don't see any data, or there certainly isn't conversation around data in the ECB or in Europe or in Canada that suggests, hey, you know, things are so bad that they should be cutting. So I'm curious as to why you think they are certainly ahead of the Fed. You know, none of this is in isolation. So there's definitely some kind of coordinated conversations going on. And then cutting rates in that environment certainly doesn't help them against the dollar. And the dollar is already causing some pain. The other thing in conjunction with that is volatility being almost near record lows. When you're looking at where the stock market is and you're looking at the risk premium that you're paying to own stocks in this environment, where the likelihood of stocks going higher, it's kind of one of those things where like, well, there's nowhere to vol to go. So in order for stocks to keep going up, like how do you suppress things any further to give that the market that extra boost? So do you see how any of those are intertwined?
Well, yeah, I think it's kind of all related. I think part of the, I think both Canada and the ECB, I think they would have much preferred for the Fed to cut first. I don't think that they wanted to be out there ahead of time, but I think their economies are slowing. And remember, I think a lot of people focus on the U.S. for good reason. We're the biggest economy, we're the biggest capital markets. I get why people do focus on it, but I don't think you can focus on the U.S. to the exclusion of all these other markets, because all these other markets have all the same problems, and in many cases, more so than the U.S. does. And so growth is slowing in those places, and inflation is, it's not crashing, but it is coming down. And so they feel like they have the ability to cut interest rates, even though inflation is high, but coming down, or it's higher than it has been historically, and it's coming down. But you also got to remember that, you know, the Canada more so than Europe, but the record house prices have driven those economies. And, you know, when housing goes up, then that leads to other consumer purchases, and it has this whole knock-on effect for the overall economy. Well, Canada has one of the highest priced housing markets in the world. And typically those mortgages, you know, I think are on a 5-year arm as far as interest rate resets. And so a lot of those are now coming up, you know, in the next, or either this year or next year, coming up for a refinance. And interest rates are much higher than they were when those were reset under the best circumstances. And so I think they're trying to get ahead of this a little bit, because if you know, if all of these resets come with rates super high, you know, it has... This kind of goes back to the design of the monetary system. And again, this kind of goes back, I'm going to go into more detail when we do this masterclass, but once you understand the design of the monetary system, even if you're in an inflationary environment, the design of the system makes it such that you can move from an inflationary scenario to a deflationary scenario extremely quickly. And I think that's why, to a certain extent, central banks are trying to get rates down a little bit, because they know that even though we're in an inflationary environment, it could transition the other way very quickly, and they don't want that to happen. Deflation is the enemy of central banks. And, you know, Powell kind of mentioned this on a couple of his, or at least in his very first press conference, when he started talking about at some point there would be appropriate for rate cuts, and that is, you don't want to go from 500 miles an hour to landing the plane in 2 seconds, right? You want to kind of slow down as you're coming in for a landing to get the smooth landing. So I think that's kind of what's going on with Europe and Canada, and why some of these other central banks are thinking about cutting now as well, because the economies are slowing. Whether or not they're crashing, that's another case, but they're not on the same trajectory that they were. Now, to your point about volatility, something does have to give eventually, right? Unless the central bankers can pull off this global soft landing, at some point, vol is going to show up somewhere. Now, whether it shows up in the actual VIX, whether it shows up in currencies, whether it shows up in bonds or equities, you know, I don't know. But to your point, it's hard to see the next 6 months being as sanguine as the last 6 months. You know, I saw Mike Green last week at this conference I was at. We were talking about volatility and how low it was. And, you know, listen, Mike knows more about volatility than I ever will. He's forgotten more about it than I'll ever know, because he's one of the world's experts on volatility. But it really does show, or he, you know, we were talking again, and, you know, he just reiterated, and I think many people have heard this by now, but it bears pointing out again, is that part of the reason that the VIX is so low is it just isn't traded as much as it used to be. And the reason that it isn't traded as much as it used to be is the rise of these 0 or 1 day to expiration options. It used to be that if you were going to hedge your portfolio, you either had to use the monthly VIX options or the monthly options on the stock or whatever it is that you were looking to hedge, right? So typically, you know, the third week of every month is when stock options or index options or the VIX options expire. But then they started having weekly options, and, you know, you could trade options that expire at the end of the week. Well, now they have them that you can trade an option that expires at the end of the day. And as a result, if let's just go back a couple weeks, let's say it was May 28th and you had had a pretty good month, pretty good year to date, and you wanted to hedge things out through the end of the month. It used to be that you had to go 3.5 weeks out in the future and buy the June puts or the, you know, the June VIX contract or whatever it was. Well, there, all you had to do was go 3 days ahead of time or 2 days ahead of time and use those options. And so as a result, you know, the monthlies aren't as important as they used to be. And you can see, you know, when the VIX kind of started to fall and kind of stayed lower in general, which was about 3 or 4 years ago, is kind of about the time that these 1 day and 0 to 0 day expiration options kind of came into the fore. And so it's not 100% causation, but it's not unrelated either.
Did he share any thoughts on what he's trying to use as signal now for volatility?
Well, really, the thing is with passive is that it's all about flows. And, you know, as long as flows keep coming in, and I'm going to really dumb this down, but this is the heart of it, is that because passive investing is rules based, there's no thinking involved. And this is really simple, but even though this is extremely simple, this is the way it actually is, which is kind of hard to believe, but it's true. And that is, when money hits the account, there's no thinking, is this a good time to buy? Is this a bad time to buy? What's the management thinking? No. The money hits the account and it immediately says buy, and it buys. Doesn't matter price, doesn't matter volatility, doesn't matter what's going on in the world, you just buy. And that creates a self-perpetuating cycle and it pushes asset prices higher. But if and when somebody says, you know what, I want some of that money back, then it doesn't matter if this is a good time to sell, it doesn't matter what's going on in the world, it doesn't matter if it'd be better to sell 2 days from now, it's sell. And if you start to get to a point where more people are asking money back than are putting money in, then you get to the downside, it becomes a self-perpetuating move to the downside. In the same way that it was a self-perpetuating move to the upside, it becomes a self-perpetuating move to the downside. And so, you know, talking to him, he wasn't sure what the flows were going to be that would cause it to go one way or the other, but there eventually will be capital. Now, it could be that, you know, due to a hole in the commercial real estate banking sector, you know, people start asking for cash, and then that starts the withdrawals. Or it could be, you know, unemployment starts to rise, people are no longer putting money into their 401ks, and they actually start taking money out, right? It's hard to determine what the flows will be, but whenever the flows go negative, it will turn down, and it will likely turn down pretty sharply.
Okay, so in terms of volatility, you know, things are extremely suppressed, at least if you're looking at some of these other indicators. And perhaps because of that, and maybe it's just overall, you know, belief that a soft landing is possible, there has been the shift in sentiment, or at least a shift in narrative, that we're more likely to have a blow off top before we see some of that volatility. What are your thoughts on that opinion?
It's interesting because last fall, there was this. And listen, I understood that. I did not think we were going to get it, but I understood the argument that we would have a melt up into the end of the year. And we got it. And to me, that was a contrarian call. Some people got it right and they made a lot of money. And, you know, hats off to them. It was a great call. I actually feel like there is more people making that call now, and I'm starting to hear it more and more. And when you look at positioning, and when you look at the fear and greed index, when you look at the put call ratio, there's not a lot of fear. And you look at the VIX, there's not a lot of fear out there. So to me, that tells me that. And then when I hear more and more about this melt up, to me, it's not a huge contrarian call anymore. It's almost consensus at this point is that this train just keeps going. And I can't rule that out. But what I would say is that, and listen, I've said this before, and I'm the first to say that, even though I've said this before, you haven't needed to do it. You have not needed to hedge your portfolio in the last year. If you were just long stocks or long NVIDIA or long whatever, Bitcoin for the last year, you did really well. And yeah, there might have been a couple of weeks or a month where, you know, kind of went against you. But in general, that's been a great trade. But if you are somebody who doesn't have a 30-year time horizon, doesn't like to experience 30, 40, 50% drawdowns or whatever it is, and you do want to, you know, kind of smooth out some of the drawdowns or take some of the risk off the table, the time to take risk off the table is when it's very cheap, to take risk off the table. Right now, with the put-call ratio pretty low, with VIX pretty low, with everybody expecting the melt-up to continue, that is the time to take some chips off the table. It doesn't guarantee that the markets are going to crash. Doesn't guarantee, but the point is that's the time to do it. What I will relate this to, John, is a couple weeks ago on my silver trade. You know, I'm not even really a silver bear. I'm really indifferent to silver, to be honest. But the point was that everybody was convinced it was going to $50. And sentiment was as high as it had been in 5 years. The relative strength was the highest it's been in 5 years. The positioning was as high as it's been in 5 years. And so if you are going to take a counter trend better, if you are going to take some risk off the table, if you are going to buy some puts in order to try to profit from a short-term reversal, that is the environment in which you do it. Now, we're not quite, and by the way, that's paid off. You know, the silver has come back. Those puts are in the money. We were able to roll them down and kind of take our initial capital off the table. And now we have the rest for free, basically. But the point, you know, bringing this back to the equity markets is, listen, I'm not telling everybody to go out and sell their whole portfolio. I'm just saying, if you are somebody who likes to take some risk off the table from time to time and play the swings a little bit, this isn't a horrible time to do that. Because right now, it's cheap insurance time right now. And if you think about what we have over the next 6 months that we haven't had over the last 6 months, is we're going to have the presidential election, which is obviously going to be crazy. And we have the potential for some more lawsuits or you know, legal cases versus Trump, which are going to cause, you know, social chaos or the potential to cause social chaos. We have the continuing war with Ukraine and Russia, and that actually seems to be escalating as opposed to calming down at all. We have the Fed is probably going to cut rates at some point, or at least they're going to be closer to cutting rates than they are now. You know, why that will be or what effect that will have, we don't know yet. So, but the point is there's a lot of stuff in the second half of the year that has the potential to send volatility, again, however that's expressed, higher. So, you know, when I look at portfolios, I'm happy if the market goes up 10% and we go up 7 or 8, that's fine with me. Again, I don't need to take every last single dollar out of the market to be successful over time.
I want to talk about GameStop, but before we do, you know, one of the things that you talk about is if you do have a bearish sentiment, it's that, you know, you're not so much in the soft landing camp, but you're not in that this is going to be some sort of GFC 2.0 or Great Depression situation. Yeah. That you're mostly, for the most part, you're going to be looking to buy that dip. Now, talking about passive and some of the things that Mike Green talks about, one of the things I found very interesting back in 2020 is, and I'm not sure how accurate this data was, but when you look at that V-shaped recovery and you analyze the sell-off, the ironic thing is the sell-off didn't actually come from the algorithms. It came from the discretionary, you could say, emotional money management, right? So people had their hands on that. Do you think, because those algos weren't necessarily triggered to sell and were to some extent diamond hands, do you think that helps your position that this, you know, if there is a pullback, it's not going to be some sort of crisis situation and that it's one to buy?
No, absolutely. And so, you know, I've said this before and I'll say it again, like my whole thesis and framework, I've stolen work from other people. Like Raul's work has gone into my thesis. Alex Gurevich's work has gone into my thesis. Mike Green's work has gone into my thesis. So, you know, but to your point, the structure of the market and the rise of passive absolutely plays a role in my thinking that markets will go higher. Because I think to a certain extent, capital will flow to U.S. equities anyway because of a relative flight to safety in an uncertain world. And, you know, when money's trying to get out of bonds. And then when flows show up, passive investment, the structure of passive investments just turbocharges it. And that is why equity markets have gone so high over. My biggest frustration is I know exactly why markets have gone up over the last year and a half. My frustration is that I haven't participated as much as I should. I've participated. We've made money. But, you know, in hindsight, I would have loved to embrace that more because I do understand the structure of the market and the flows that are causing it to go higher. And so if we do get a sell-off, we already have the Fed with markets at their all-time high saying, telling us they want to cut rates. So if we get a hard sell-off, they are going to be cutting, they're going to be providing more stimulus, and you know, that will contribute to flows that then go into equities, and then the passive investments can then take it higher. So to your point, yeah, I think that that is a big reason why I don't think we're going to go into this Great Depression.
Not to stretch this out too much further, but the weaponization of the dollar comes to mind here, because I'm thinking about, again, what these other countries are potentially going to do. To an extent, they're importing inflation, and ultimately, by cutting their interest rates, it's going to make the dollar stronger. Now, one would think that it's going to be this kind of currency war relative game where everybody does a tit for tat, but maybe the U.S. stands tall longer, doesn't cut rates longer, and you just see this immense strengthening in the dollar on a relative basis to kind of punish our enemies, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, that's easily possible. And the thing is the reason that equities have continued to hold up, and the reason this hasn't been a disaster for the U.S. economy so far, despite the higher rates, is that that is why we are getting the flows. We've talked about this before, but the milkshake is in many ways the George Soros's imperial circle on a master scale. And what the imperial circle says is that if you have a country that has high interest rates, or relatively tight monetary policy relative to other countries, and you have a government in that country that is spending a lot and stimulating the economy, that is actually a recipe for asset prices to go a lot higher, because the higher rates pull capital in, the government spending money stimulates the economy and pushes things higher, and then you get the locals putting their money back into the economy, and you get the knock-on effect of these passive investments that just follow along with it. And that's how you get this melt-up. Markets, part of my reason that I think we're going to get a correction is that's what markets do. Markets don't go in straight lines. And if I take this back to silver, it's not that I'm a silver bear. It's just that I know that things don't go straight up forever. So there will be a pullback. I think that's likely the same thing in U.S. equities. We've had this really strong move up. We're probably going to get a 10 or 15% correction. Maybe it'll be worse than that. Maybe it'll be less than that. But then I think we move higher after that. To me, it's not that markets have to continue going higher, and it's not that they can't go lower. It's whether or not you feel what is most important for your portfolio is, and everybody's different. If the thing that's most important for your portfolio is catching every dollar of upside, then you invest differently than somebody whose goal is to beat inflation and kind of just, you know, protect the size of their stack, so to speak. And so I think you got to be really honest with what it is you're trying to achieve and the risk level you're willing to take to achieve it.
Speaking of self-awareness about what kind of investor you are and things not going in a straight line, let's get your thoughts on GameStop. You had Roaring Kitty doing this live stream. He's got these options. Do you want to talk about some of the things you're seeing in the option pricing and any kind of feedback or thoughts you have on that whole charade?
Sure. You know, I'd be really interested to know I haven't followed this super closely, so maybe this news is already out there and I just don't know. I'd be really curious to know when he acquired those options and what they cost him. Again, not the strike price. I think the strike price is pretty well known, but what he paid for them, I'd be really interested to know. The first thing I'll say with regard to, what's his name? Gill? His last name's Gill? Is it Keith Gill?
Yes.
Yeah,
Something very close to that.
Yeah, so I tweeted something out the other day. Listen, whether he ends up a billionaire or broke, I don't know. But regardless, he's a first, and he's an inductee into the Big Balls Hall of Fame, you know, first ballot. I mean, it's just incredible. So from that perspective, you got to love him, right? And listen, what's funny is people are saying that he's manipulating the market. Well, I mean, Jesus Christ, all these other billionaires go on TV and talk about their position. So what's the difference, you know? But I will say, again, this gets back to the world you want versus the world that is. Listen, he is going up against the biggest, most powerful people, and he's probably going to lose. Now, I know there's a lot of diamond hands out there and, you know, kitty cultists who are going to come at me and say, oh, Brent, you're just supporting the powers that be. Listen, I'm not supporting the powers that be. I'm just telling you, most people who storm the castle end up getting killed. And that's probably what's going to happen here. Now, if he wins, I'll be the first one to hold up my hand and say, well done. That's pretty cool. And I'm very happy for him. I'm just, for all the retail who are out there riding along with him, ride or die, you know, the second word is probably going to be what happens, right? So you look at yesterday, you know, people on Thursday night, people were saying, if the stock closes at 60, he's a billionaire. Well, it closed below 30, right? And at one point yesterday, I was looking, or maybe it was 2 days ago, I was looking at the options prices just to see, like, what would it cost to hedge this? If you thought instead of going higher, it was going to go lower, how much would the puts cost? And I looked up, and the implied volatility on the puts was like 400% or something, just some crazy, crazy number. So as an example, if we were going to hedge an at the money, if we were going to buy an at the money put on the S&P 500 a week to expire next week, you know, June 21st, the implied volatility on that is probably like 12, 13, 14% or something like that, which is an input into the price of the option. At the time when I was looking at the 1 week options on GME, the implied volatility was like 400, 14 versus 400. So as an example, if you're going to buy a put on GME right now, I think the stock's around 28. If you're going to buy an at the money put, I think the at the money put for 1 week is $7 or $8, which means the stock would have to go down 25% for you to break even in a week. Now, here's the thing with GME, that might just happen. So, but the point is that I don't know how much he spent to get those options that were worth, you know, several hundred million dollars, or that at least they were a couple of days ago. I don't know what I think they're maybe down below par value now. But I'd be really curious to know what the implied volatility was on those when he bought them. He probably did it. My guess is that he did it over a long period of time when nobody was looking at the stock and just slowly accumulated him. So I'm highly confident it's much lower than the implied volatility now, but it would be interesting to know how much money he spent to get that position.
Yeah, I think all the emphasis was on this 60 some dollar strike price because everyone was excited about him becoming a billionaire. One of the things I read today, and who knows if it's accurate, is that he did pay a much more attractive price for them. And so although things are below $30, I think he actually is doing quite well at the moment. One of the things that's kind of funny about that is obviously there's a lot of meme culture and a lot of retail euphoria and support behind it. There's this really funny meme that's used all the time for different reasons. I can't remember what movie it's from, but there's people in the church. There's three people sitting in a pew, and then there's a guy at a balcony with like a sniper gun on all of them.
Yeah.
The front person is GameStop. The person behind him has, you know, a gun on him, and it says short sellers. And then behind the short sellers is Roaring Kitty. And then in the balcony is GameStop again, because one of the aspects of this whole story is GameStop decided to sell, 75 million shares or something?
Yeah, at the highs, right? I mean, that's the retail is basically just giving their money to GameStop, like, yeah, just here, take my money, and they're not going to get anything back for it, and everybody else is getting diluted at that anyway. But it's just,
yeah, we'll see what happens. You know, GameStop could become someone made an interesting point. You know, what Ryan Cohen and GameStop should do with all that money is basically turn themselves into like a MicroStrategy, just buy a crap load of Bitcoin and sell bonds. Sure. Look, we'll wrap it up here. I didn't mention it before when we were talking about the masterclass. If you want to learn more about that, we're still kind of in this early bird window where we're collecting emails. Anyone who, you know, kind of raises their hand now will have an opportunity to get involved with the masterclass at an early bird price. So go ahead and send us an email at masterclass@milkshakespod.com. It's masterclass@milkshakespod.com. If you haven't already and you're, you know, somebody who's on Twitter and active there, check out macro_alchemist for more on that, and stay tuned for this, you know, I guess you could say series one, volume one think piece, just to kind of get people prepared for what we're going to be doing with the Macro Alchemist. Brett, I think we can wrap it up there. Any last words before we say adieu to everybody and let them enjoy their weekend?
No, just have a great weekend. We got Fed meeting next week, so next week's episode should be interesting.
Good stuff. Look, check out Brent on Twitter at SantiagoAUFund. You can find me there, John Kutzmita. You can find this channel on YouTube and Twitter using the handle MilkshakesPod. We appreciate all of you, and we'll see you next week.
This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.